welcome Rabbi Rami Shapiro as our speaker today. Rabbi Rami was ordained as a Reform Rabbi in 1981, and he earned a doctorate in religious studies in 1985. You can listen to his podcast, Essential Conversations, at spiritualityandhealth.com. Many of you read his column called Roadside Assistance for the Spiritual Traveler that he writes for Spirituality and Health magazine. Rabbi Rami's topic today is Succoth and the Wisdom of Insecurity. Let's welcome Rabbi Rami.
Good morning. So, I like the way you pronounce Succoth. Just suck it. I like the way you pronounced it better. Hebrew, it's Succoth, but it's just suck it. You know, that made sense to me. Okay, so I was here, 2 weeks ago, I think? Yeah, which probably accounts for the small turnout. we just heard this guy, right? So I was talking about, I'd make it a pop quiz and ask you, but I won't do that. I was talking about the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I thought I'd just complete the fall cycle and the next holiday, which is really just about ending, ends tomorrow night. There's another holiday on Tuesday, but we'll forget that one. And that is Succoth. Succoth means booths. And if you go to any synagogue, they'll tell you that Succoth is named after the booths that the Hebrews built as they wandered for 40 years in the Sinai desert, which is total BS. And if someone tells you that's what Succoth means, you should say, suck it. Because that's not right. They're in the desert. There's no wood to go out and build these. Because the way you build a sukkah is with these wooden poles and then a thatched roof. And you're not going to find all the stuff you need to build it and to continually rebuild it everywhere you go. They lived in tents. Other parts of the Bible will tell you that. But we have this holiday, and it's one of the three pilgrimage holidays where you're supposed to go to Jerusalem and offer animal sacrifice in the temple. It's in the Bible, so they had to come up with some reason to do it, and this is what they came up with, that it's got this historical reference to wandering in the desert. It's got nothing to do with that. It is the fall harvest. It's essentially Thanksgiving in the Jewish calendar. And you build these booths because we used to build the booths to house the harvest. You'd build these flimsy structures, and as you gathered in the harvest, you'd store it there, and the workers would even sleep in there. And then eventually, when it was all gathered in and taken to market, the huts were just taken apart and tossed out or recycled or whatever they did, repurposed. But it's fundamentally a harvest holiday. And if that's all it was, I wouldn't be all that interested in it, because really, nature and I don't get along. But, because there's bugs. I don't get that, you know? So anyway, added on to the whole notion of the harvest is another dimension about insecurity. So I'm going to come to that in a second. But I wanted to actually do this with you, or have you do it while I go talk about the rest. This is the part of the ritual that deals with the harvest part. So you build this hut and you decorate it with the fruits of the season, the harvest stuff. But then you have to go out and either you make or you buy. I don't know anyone who makes these. I get them from Israel. It's called a lulav and an etrog. So the lulav consists of a palm branch, some myrtle, and willow branches. And they're all put together with this, woven, and that's also palm, I think, woven holders. So you have these, and then you have the citrus. And what you want to do on Succoth is you give thanks for the harvest that's now, but you try to pray for good harvest everywhere, not just your own. So what you do, and I'm going to have you do it if you want to do it, is you take, and be very careful if you do this, because the palm fronds are really sharp, and and they'll go under your nails, and it's, I mean, I've already, oh, I did it again. So it hurts. So you take this in your right hand. This is considered, the kids are off to camp, right? Off to school. So this is the masculine symbol. Right? This is the penis. And this is the feminine symbol. And you bring them together when you do the ritual. I'll show you in a second. This also represents, because you hold this in your right hand, and that's the hand of logic and reason. And you hold the etrog in the left, which is supposed to be the hand of art and creativity and myth and that kind of. So you're putting together not just the male and the masculine and the feminine, but also those aspects that of logic and, you know, it's logos and mythos, they call it, the reason and so the imagination. And then you have to shake it. So you shake it in all six directions, starting east. Now I have no idea where east is. That way? So you start to the east, and then you go around, you know, you shake it in each direction three times. And the three represents your own personal harvest within your life. And then the second time you do it, it's a harvest between you and those friends and loved ones in that relationship. And the third time, it's sort of, you could say, global harvest or cosmic harvest, you know, beyond the personal and the interpersonal, the transpersonal. So you're going to do it three times in each direction. And that's four. And then you go up and then down. And then you hand it to somebody else. So I won't go through all the liturgy for it. It's really not relevant. But come up with your own thing as this goes around. You know, what harvests are you thankful for within, between, and beyond? And do it in all six directions. Does that make sense, what I'm asking you to do? All right, and then you pass it on to someone else. What?
You're like a rosary.
Like a rosary?
Saying the rosary.
Oh, okay.
Repeated and doing.
Yeah, well, okay. All right. So, thank you, our communist Catholics. So, the Pope is here, and now you're like totally into being Catholic now. Don't forget, you met with Kim Davis.
No.
So, okay. Anyway, so I'm going to pass this around. I don't know who wants to start. As you pass it to someone, be careful to pass it with this part and not here and stab them through the chest with it, right? And if you don't want to do it, you don't have to bother doing it. And I'm going to talk about the rest of the holiday, and you'll just be doing this as we go along. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Anybody, you want to start? Who wants to? Okay, we're going to start over here.
So, that's in your right hand. This is in your left hand. Then your right. You stand up and you put them together. Yeah, then you go to the east. All right.
Hey, yeah, yeah, hey. Yeah.
Okay, do you go around three times?
No, you go around once, but each direction is three times.
Each direction, three shakes.
Okay. Yeah, three shakes. All right, so I realize there's no point in my talking because we're looking for someone to screw this up. All right, well, if I wait for everyone who wants to do it, I will be here all day, which wouldn't bother me, but I'd be here by myself. So while we're doing that, the other thing that you do on Sukkot, and you're supposed to live in the sukkah, which I have tried to do more than once, but it never works for me. So anyway, you eat in there, and you invite family, you invite friends, and traditionally you invite the patriarchs and matriarchs of the Bible to join you in your sukkah, which it's really good to invite them because they are very cheap guests. They don't actually ask for food or anything like the other people you invite. But when you invite people into the sukkah to study the book of Ecclesiastes. So that's the book that's read in this holiday. Ecclesiastes is an odd choice for a harvest celebration. Because Ecclesiastes, maybe you think it isn't. But Ecclesiastes is about uncertainty and insecurity and lack of control and how to live in a world like that. So I want to start with just a passage from one of the great scholars of Ecclesiastes, a guy named Siao, and he's a Korean guy. And He's writing about 5th century BCE, before the Common Era. He's trying to give us a sense of how people lived then. This was not a world of farming villages, but of global commerce. Theirs was a world of money, commerce, and investment. It was also a world of loans, mortgages, and foreclosures. For the ordinary citizen, the smallholder, the homesteader, the worker, there was much about which to worry, but not much about which one could be certain. The reality of the Persian period economy, when Ecclesiastes was written, is that individuals were caught in the ties of swift political and economic changes, and most people were helpless in the face of all that was happening. I mean, that sounds like now, right? It's a 5th century BCE, so 2,600 years ago, version of what we're experiencing now. The same thing. There's a bunch of readings you can in the commentaries that tell you that these were people who were, everything of value was gone and all they had was money. And then they didn't even have that. So, you know, earlier cultures, land was the value. In the Bible itself, land is the ultimate value, which is why you can't sell it except under dire circumstances. And even if you do sell it, you get it back in 49 years, so your family never loses it completely, because that's where the value was. But by the time you got to the 5th century BCE, the land was owned by absentee landlords, people who didn't live anywhere near where you lived. And this goes on for centuries. This is the world that Jesus occupies, a world of subsistence farmers, people who are just working the land that they no longer own. And it never comes back to them in the Jubilee year, as the Bible says. They never get it back. And all they have is really subsistence living. And there's no way to change it as far as they can tell. Now, there's revolutions coming. But, you know, as far as the people for whom Ecclesiastes wrote, they weren't a people with a lot of hope. So the book opens with what most English translations render vanity of vanities, everything is vanity, or meaninglessness upon meaninglessness, all life is meaningless, or futility upon futility, all life is futile. I mean, it's depressing. And you could see why some commentators read it that way, because the life of these people was depressing. But Ecclesiastes isn't really talking about maintaining that depression. He's really talking about overcoming it. And the words that he uses, and I've talked about this before at length, so I'm not going to go into it deeply, but the word is havel havalim, which means, havel means breath. So it's like breath upon breath. All life is breath. Or it's like dew in the morning, where, you know, the grass is wet in the morning, but by 10, 11 o'clock, it's all burned away. He's saying that nothing lasts, nothing is permanent, and that the extent to which we try to gain control and to make things last is the extent to which we are miserable. So, but most people read this book backwards. So let me just give you some text right after he tells you that everything is impermanent. He says, the sun rises only to set and then races breathless to the place of rising once more. So people read this, and the traditional translations, the traditional commentary says, what a waste. The sun can't rest either. The sun rises and then it goes down and it's got to rise again. It's exhausting, just like our lives are exhausting. The wind spins without end, one moment southward, the next moment northward. There's no controlling of it. All rivers empty into the sea, but the sea never fills. Indeed, the waters rise and return to the river's mouth that they might flow again, you know, rising through evaporation and then coming down through rain. So people are reading this and saying, well, look, just life is just a meaningless round of activity that never culminates in anything. But if you read it more carefully, especially if you read my translation, and you look at the Hebrew more carefully, what he's saying is He's celebrating these things. I mean, just imagine if the sun went up once and then said, been there, done that, and never came back. That's not a good thing. What if? Well, actually, we have the answer to this. What if the seas were full? We know. I mean, you know, we just had the anniversary of Katrina, right? I mean, we know what happens when the seas are full. We know what's coming with climate change. So he's not saying how awful the seas are never full. He's really saying how fantastic it doesn't end. Impermanence implies, at least in Ecclesiastes, ongoingness. That there's just this dynamic that just keeps going on and on and on. Now, there is a negative side to it. And he says that the eye is never satisfied with seeing. And some of the commentators say, and this could be true, that what it means is there's always another sparkly thing to buy. Oh, I have all this stuff. Or, you know, in our story by Vladimir Putin, you know, I have a house, now I want this, and now I want a palace, and then I want to be emperor, the whole thing. So, we're never satisfied. And that's, you know, that's a criticism that he's making. But imagine, just to stick with the other way of looking at it, imagine if what your eye right now is filled with seeing, and that was it. Either you never saw anything else again, or this is all you ever saw, over and over and over and over again. He's celebrating impermanence. But he's also celebrating, he's also commenting elsewhere in the book, after he tells you, look, the nature of life is impermanent, insecure. There's nothing you can rely on. And he goes through a whole list of things. There's nothing you can rely on. He then says, and we live in a very dangerous time. And he says, he's got this wonderful line where he says, if you're disgruntled with the government, don't even tell your lover in bed. Because there's a bird. This is what a little bird told me, that thing. That it comes from Ecclesiastes. Because a bird will carry it to the government. Now, he doesn't literally mean a wren. Right? This is a very apt story for today. He's not talking about an actual bird. What's he talking about? Yeah, spies on the street. He says people are spying on one another. They're wandering the streets with their ears to your windows, to your bedroom, and they'll hear you complaining about the government, and they'll race and report you. So you can't trust anyone. You can trust your loved one, but you can't trust people in general. You can't trust the government. He goes on about how they're only interested in exploiting you. You can't, there's nothing you can rely on. There's no God in here. The only reference to God in Ecclesiastes is a very abstract reference. He calls God the God, and it's usually the equivalent of nature, as opposed to a self-conscious being that's either sanctioned this world or, you know, calls you to do something else. God is irrelevant to your life. Other than God as nature is impermanent and, you know, sets the stage for your life. So the wisdom he finds in this, because I call this the wisdom of insecurity, is that when you stop trying to control, you find you have a lot of room to maneuver within, you know, that the confines of both the natural world, which is impermanent, and the political world in which you live, which is oppressive. He says you still have room to maneuver. And I'll give you his maneuvering thing in a second. But chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes is probably the most famous part. So, because it's the bird song. Originally, I guess, it's before them, Dylan did it. Or did Pete Seeger write it? No, Bob Dylan wrote it, I think. So, you know, to everything there is a season, turn, turn, turn. Sing. No. So, the Hebrew can be read in different ways. Season sounds big. I took the Hebrew as moments, because things are really changing all the time. So everything in this world has its moment, a season of ripening and falling away, moments of birthing and moments of dying, moments of planting and moments of reaping, moments of killing and moments of healing, moments of demolition and moments of building. And it goes on and on and on. It's got a list. I don't have to read the whole thing to you. But weeping and laughing and mourning and dancing and scattering stones and picking stones up, moments of birthing and moments of dying. And we heard that during Joey's and Concerns. Life is simply one moment after the other. The moments are always in a state of transition. Nothing lasts beyond its time, beyond its moment, beyond its season. So when I do my work in spiritual direction, we have a training program out of St. Mary's. One of the things that we do in the St. Mary's spiritual direction program is we teach people how to use the I Ching, the Book of Changes. Because the Book of Changes, this is true. I believe what I just read to you is true, that we're always in this moment of transition. And the Book of Changes from the Chinese helps us imagine what the current moment is, and if it's already run its course and about to change into something else, what the next moment is going to be. Sometimes you're in the middle of it and there is no next moment yet, you can't see. But the Book of Changes looks at both the moment you're in and if there is a transition coming, where that moment is going. I don't believe that the I Ching should be taken literally. I don't even know how you take it literally. It's too fortune cookie-esque. Right? But it is a trigger for your own self-inquiry into what's going on in your life. Applying one of those esoteric statements to your life is a way of triggering your imagination and getting it flowing and saying, okay, maybe this is what it means. And then as you look, you say, oh yeah, I get it. This is the moment I'm in, and this is where it's going, if it's going anywhere, right now. So he's saying you have to know two things. You have to know the moment you're in, and you have to know that it's not permanent. He doesn't say where it's going, because it all depends on your situation. But look to the I Ching for that. But to recognize that there are moments, but the moments never last, is his first gift of wisdom within the insecurity. It's not like you can escape the mess. It's insecurity. Nothing lasts. But if you know that nothing lasts, he says, you will either appreciate what's to be appreciated, if it's a good moment, more intensely, because it's not going to last, or you will grieve in moments of grief, but you won't catastrophize. Is that the psychological term? Where you say, oh, it's always going to be this way. It's always bad. Because nothing is always anything. It's constant change. So the first thing you have to do with this is to figure out, and this is what you do in the sukkah with your loved ones, is you try to figure out what moment am I in? What season am I in? What's going on with me? Obviously, you invite people, you have this discussion with people you trust, not with the little bird who's going to report it to the government, and you're in trouble. But he says, everything is beautiful in its moment, but the ripening is hidden from your mind, and you cannot comprehend beginnings or endings. Even the negative has its own intrinsic beauty, but we're not always aware of it. From this, I concluded, it is best for you to rejoice in what is and devote your life to goodness. This is the gift of reality. Here it comes. This is the gift of reality. Eat and drink and find work that pleasures your heart. I'm just going to add two more things in a second. But eat and drink and find work that pleasures your heart. So he's got a whole chapter about over-drinking. He's got a whole section where he went out, because Ecclesiastes, the person himself, Ecclesiastes is not a name, it's a title, it means the teacher. Who he was, no one really knows, but in the book he pretends he was King Solomon. And so he imagines that he has money to do anything he wants. So, and he does, he builds, just like the book, it's so apropos. He builds palaces for himself and all that, and nothing gives him joy. And he says here, look, I was happy at the moment, but nothing lasts. It was like, oh, no, I've been there, done that. What am I going to do next? I'm going to be emperor, and then I'm going to be a god, right? So he goes through all of that, and he's never satisfied. And then he goes through women. He decides that will make him happy, because King Solomon had 900 wives and concubines. So he has all the women he wants. He goes, that didn't do it either. It gets old. And then he goes through food, and then he goes through alcohol, and he tries everything. And he's got this line where he says, look, I don't want you to think it wasn't fun at the time, but it didn't last. That's it. I enjoyed it while I was doing it, but it didn't last. Nothing gives me a sense of lasting joy, except eating and drinking moderately is where he goes with this, and then finding work, which he didn't really have. So you can see where the metaphor or the pretense that he's King Solomon breaks down. But finding work that brings you joy, and the work he's talking about is physical labor. You know, so you know, in the Buddhist tradition, it's chopping wood and hauling water. I mean, that kind of basic thing should bring you joy. Thich Nhat Hanh's notion that washing dishes should bring you joy, and that's what he goes to. But then he adds a couple of other things. So if you're going to work, he says, don't work alone. Working with a partner is better than working alone, and together you can earn greater reward. And if you should fall down, your friend can lift you up. So this is for my family at the moment, this is a big deal. My mother is going to have her 87th birthday. My dad died last March. We finally convinced my mother to wear one of those I've fallen and I can't get up buttons, things. So just last week, she was driving, hit it with while she was driving, set off the alarm. The alarm company doesn't call 911. Not that they could find her in a car anyway. The alarm company doesn't call 911. They call you to see how you are. My mother's deaf. So they called. I mean, she wasn't home anyway. But even if she was, she wouldn't hear the phone. And so they couldn't get a response, which we thought meant better call 911. She could be in big trouble. But they didn't. They called my sister at work. By the time my sister got back to them, my sister said, look, we're going to cancel this because if this is how it works, she'll just be dead anyway. Why am I paying all this money? So he doesn't imagine it this way. He thinks your partner is going to be around so that if you should fall, your friend can lift you up. How sad to fall alone and with none to raise you. So you have to have friends. Stuck. Then he says, all right. Now he's talking about friends, partners at work, but then his mind is wandering a little bit. And at night in bed, you can warm one another. Now, I don't know if he's still talking about your business partner. I don't know if this is friends with benefits. I'm not sure what this is. Because no one gets married in here, right? But at night in bed, you can warm one another. For how does one who sleeps alone stay warm? That's what electric blankets are for. But they didn't have electricity. And when alone, you may be overpowered. Two can withstand an attacker. And a three-ply cord is not easily severed. So first it was just one friend. Now he says, well, two friends are better. Now I don't know if he means three of you in bed. I don't know what. But that's why the Bible is X-rated. I think we're at the end of banned books week. The Bible is one of the banned books always. So this is how he sort of brings it all to a close. So what is worthwhile? You're living in the sukkah, because you're reading this in the sukkah. You're in the sukkah. The sukkah is open to the elements. The sides are not closed. The roof is thatched. So like when it rains in. So you're living in this fragile environment. There's nothing you can do to overcome it. I mean, one of the implicit messages of Sukkot is sort of the opposite of the three little pigs. Because the three little pigs, the enemy is the wolf. And while you can't stop the wolf with straw house and you can't stop the wolf with a twig house, you can stop the wolf with a brick house. But in Ecclesiastes and in the holiday of Sukkot, there's no way to stop the wolf. Whatever the wolf is, whether it's the government or old age or accident or whatever you're imagining, illness, whatever it is, you can't avoid the wolf. So you're living in this shelter that is open to the elements. But you're bringing your friends in. And you're celebrating the harvest, the fertility in the midst of the fragility of the sukkah. So he says, what is worthwhile? To eat simply, to eat and drink simply, to find pleasure in your daily tasks, to cultivate two or three good friends. And then he says, to have clean clothes and oil for your hair. So this is what you need to be happy. You need enough food, you know, you need healthy food, clean water, a job that brings meaning to your life, clothes that you like, and cosmetics. That's how he works this all out. And if that's true for you as an individual, then the commentators say you have to apply it globally. Because the whole earth is a fragile structure. Not the earth itself. I mean, I don't think we can destroy the earth. It'll come back like the forest does after a fire. It just won't be the same. But will be gone, which doesn't bother me too much. But it doesn't really bother me at all. If we do that, we do that. And that was the experiment, and it failed. But what's, you know, he's talking about an individual. The commentators say, then you have to create a world that has sufficient food, healthy food for everybody, water for everybody, a world where everyone has an opportunity to find work that's meaningful, a work where friendship and love is respected, and we would say now, regardless of how you define it, a world in which everyone has sufficient clothing, and everyone has, I don't know, Mary Kay, I don't know. You know, oil on your hair was a way of keeping yourself cool, so maybe it's air conditioning. I'm not really sure how we would translate that. But it gives you, I think, it gives us a platform for a sort of a biblical call to a new way of living in, with, on, as, you know, the planet that is much more healthy than the world in which people lived when he wrote it, and much more healthy than the world that we live in when we're reading it. And doing this every year reminds us that two things, and I'm going to end. One is, even if we did everything, still the world is impermanent, right? Still stuff happens that's causing us suffering. It's just the way, it's just, can't change the nature of reality. But that's point one. The point two is you ask yourself, both as an individual and as a community, so where are we, where am I, where are we in living this way and helping others live this way? Which is why I think this is the most important holiday of the whole Jewish cycle. The fall is the most important season in the Jewish cycle, but this is the most important holiday. Rosh Hashanah celebrates the creation of humanity. Yom Kippur asks us, you know, where we are ethically and morally. But Sukkot takes it beyond the individual into the immediate family, friends, and then the planet as a whole. And really presents a challenge, because this is the beginning of the Jewish year, right? So it presents a challenge at the beginning of each year to assess where we are and then to spend the rest of the year trying to move farther along. So anyway, thank you very much for listening to that. We're going to explore some of this more in TalkBack. Everyone who wanted to, well, there's the Lulav and the Etrog. If someone didn't get a chance to do it and you want to do it during the break, please be my guest, but don't stab yourself. Thank you.